Welcome to the ALICM. Today we have Benjamin Rossman on the podcast, who is a very accomplished machine learning expert. So just to name his accolades and what he currently does, he's a professor at the University of Witwatersrand, director of the Mind Institute, director of the Rail Lab, co-founder of Lalapa AI, co-founder of Deep Learning in Darbar, CIFA, fellow in learning and machine and brains, and he's won multiple awards from Google, the Faculty Research Award, the Africa Research Award, and he's got many more other things that he can shout about, which I'll let him introduce himself formally now.
Great, thanks so much. Yeah, it's great to be here with you. Thanks for the invitation. Yeah, I think you nailed that pretty well.
No problem. And what has been, I'd say, your most exciting achievement in the last year or so, would you say?
So in the last year, that was really about kind of putting together and launching the Mind Institute, which is our AI institute at the University of the Witwatersrand, which is based in Johannesburg in South Africa. And I say AI institute, but really it's an institute focused on kind of the study of intelligence, whether it's artificial or natural. And so we're trying to look at this from all sorts of different angles. And we've done this by bringing together a number of academics, 34 academics in disciplines ranging from AI through to neuropsychology, neuroanatomy, evolutionary sciences, but also philosophy and policy and all sorts of different areas, to really try and think about the problem in as interdisciplinary a way as possible.
That's really important because the whole point of ALICM is positive provocation around AI. So thinking about how we can use AI in positive ways across public, private, and academic sectors, and bringing them all together so that people can work together to create a holistic view of what AI should be and how we should deploy it for the future of humanity. Because imagine in 50 years what we can achieve. I think in 50 years, we're going to be in a great place.
Yeah, right. And you know, we're trying to, well, firstly, we're focusing on thinking about the fundamental science. This isn't something that's had a lot of effort put into it, at least in Africa, and actually focusing on advancing the field itself rather than, say, applications of AI, for example. And so we're taking this as a core foundation of what we're doing. But then, again, we're making sure that we're touching on all sorts of different areas. And this will range from, you know, when we move into the supplied space, we've got a number of projects in areas like healthcare. We've just released or just announced a big project in AI and African music. We're doing a lot of work in the future of work. So really, we're trying to look at, you know, all these different areas that AI touches on and the impacts that the more fundamental research at the core can have in different sectors.
That's a really interesting area. I think advancing the way that neural networks are working, or maybe coming up with a new way of AI learning that is beyond neural networks, which we can't comprehend right now, would be amazing. So creating something that's better than modeling the human brain would be fascinating for me. So what first sparked your interest in machine learning or machine intelligence?
I mean, this goes back to kind of when I first went to university, I was really into coding and I thought I wanted to be a game designer. This was, like, to me, the coolest thing that I could do. I've always been a strong believer in doing the coolest thing that you can do. And that was game design. So that led me into computer science. And towards the end of the degree, we started dabbling a little bit in things that kind of fall into the AI space. And I must say, from the beginning, I was hooked. I didn't realize, like, this was a thing real life people could actually work on. And when I finished my undergrad, I wanted to study further because, you know, I was bitten by this bug. And there weren't really opportunities to kind of study further in South Africa at that time, in in kind of AI and machine learning. So I ended up going to the UK. I went to the University of Edinburgh to do my master's there. And I was just hit by it. Like, I had all these crazy subjects I could choose from, and I ended up choosing all the robotics and machine learning topics. Again, this was just the coolest, most sci-fi thing I could possibly imagine. And then I was like full on down the rabbit hole. And like, you know, again, this was like, wow, I can actually get to work on these things. And it very much aligned with the way I was thinking. I'd always been interested in kind of natural intelligence, not thinking about it as a kind of academic discipline, but there's just things I was curious about. And I found all of this coming together, all the different topics I'd been interested in at different points in my life just dovetailed so beautifully into this field. It just felt so natural. And there was, you know, so much space for really the kind of deep hardcore mathematics, but at the same time, kind of thinking creatively about kind of solving new problems and kind of tackling new challenges in the field, that really I just went all in on this. And, you know, I also, it even struck me back then that, you know, if you're thinking about intelligence at its core, this has ramifications for everything. Like everything we do as humans, everything we value, you know, that we've built as a society comes back to that we've somehow been intelligent about doing something. And, you know, to the contrary, when we have failures, it's often a failure of intelligence. And so it struck me that, you know, regardless of what you're kind of interested in, where you want to make an impact in the world, if your kind of real academic focus is around some aspect of intelligence, that's really important.
Yeah, I'm quite intrigued by the ability to solve complex problems using machines. And interestingly enough, your background or your makeup of your mind is similar to Demis Hassabis, because he, the CEO of DeepMind by Google, who invented AlphaGo, one of the pioneers of AI in our current generation, Nobel Prize winner, loved developing games, and he develops a company back in the day that developed games. So you are very similar to him. Do you take a lot of inspiration from Demis?
I mean, I really kind of respect what he's built. You know, back then, this was, I guess I was doing all of this before I knew he existed. It was only kind of really towards the end of my PhD and post that DeepMind became a thing. I must say, I always really liked what they were doing and found that interesting. I think it's kind of a natural path to fall down and this kind of road of curiosity around being able to, you know, I think an aspect about video games is like creating worlds and like new realities and questioning what realities could look like or how interactions could work. And then you realize, hang on, there's interactions in games that are about, you know, players and other entities. And hang on, this is about intelligence. And again, it all comes back to that being just such a fascinating topic on its own.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I'm sure you've seen The Matrix, the film, but it feels like there could be a convergence of the game world they're talking about plus AI and agents. And not exactly like The Matrix, but in a world where we can have a new world that we can't even imagine at the moment.
Maybe a less dystopian version.
Yes, exactly. I think there's a positive world in the future where we can enter virtual worlds to unlock more creativity, to explore maybe places that we can't explore. So let's say, for example, if we want to go to Mars now, we can't physically go to Mars without particular gear on, but in the future we can go and visit Mars virtually, walk on the planet, etc., etc. So we can start exploring places in the universe without needing to be physically there as well. That could be an amazing future.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of thing is super cool, but also very interesting from like the flip side of that is that, you know, as, you know, a species of apes that managed to somehow find its way out of like running away from saber-toothed tigers and instead into like the realm of being able to build smartphones, that's pretty wild that we managed to accomplish this, right? And I think it's interesting to see how amazing it is that we've built all these things, but also the kind of challenges that we face. And we see this with like every new generation of technology in like the way we as individuals, as societies adapt to our new discoveries, our new breakthroughs that kind of very quickly become our kind of standard everyday way of living. I mean, if you think about, you know, the internet and social media and cell phones and all of these technologies and the impact they've had, but now coming to AI, we see, you know, the fanfare that the big, you know, LLM started being released with, and in the space of just a couple of years, how they've come to dominate conversations in like every sector, that you can't look anywhere without news headlines being going on about them, how a huge percentage of the global population is using these things. It's kind of crazy how quickly we adopt these things. And, you know, then to think about like the ramifications, what does this mean for ... you know, anything from being human to how we communicate to how we trade off real worlds versus virtual worlds. You know, I think it's just fascinating what this does for, you know, many questions in areas like philosophy and social sciences and so on about, you know, how do humans actually deal with this? Again, it's pretty crazy that we can.
Yeah, it is very crazy, but it's also rapidly evolving, right? I imagine in 10 years' time, we're going to be in a place where maybe we can fix massive issues like curing diseases forever, incurable ones at the moment. I've got another question for you. So you work on the Mind Institute. What is that about, and how can people listen to this podcast, get involved or learn from it?
So really, again, what this is about is bringing together all these different academics. And the way we, you know, I think of a lot of the kind of role that I have directing this is about finding ways to bring different people together and enable really these cross-disciplinary conversations. You know, famously, everybody working in different areas speaks a different language. And so the challenge is getting people to bridge those divides and do new things. So the way we think about this is we have, at least internally for our what we call the fellows of the Institute, we have regular kind of workshops and gatherings where we kind of do deep dives into different topics. You know, these could range from AI safety through to things like consciousness or sleep. We bring kind of our community together with speakers to discuss these topics. Sometimes we instead get people to give feedback on certain projects they're working on. And really it's about getting them to pique each other's interests in these topics. And then we kind of have a seed fund where we encourage them to kind of collaborate on new crazy ideas together and try and support those projects in different ways, like whether that's financially, whether that's giving them kind of postdocs to help some of these projects. And the idea is to kind of get them to leave their comfort zones of what they normally work on and find natural areas to interact with people from different disciplines, different ways of thinking. So a lot of what we've been building so far has been about that, been trying to facilitate these kinds of conversations. We're now about to launch like a seminar series, and we're looking at more avenues now to become more public-facing in the kind of work we're doing. Because I really think with where we are in kind of the development of AI, it's really important that people that aren't just in academia, that are in different sectors of the public, are better informed about what's happening in AI, are able to actually contribute to that conversation, particularly because, you know, we know that there's a lot of risks in a lot of different ways. As we were kind of saying a few minutes ago, like any rapidly changing technology is going to change society around it. And I think it's really important that we make sure that this is done in a kind of favorable way. We know there's like this huge laundry list of possible ways that bad things could happen from AI, and inevitably bad stuff will happen. I mean, this is the nature of anything new that we don't quite understand yet. But the more that like just your average person in society is aware of how the developments are progressing, what the implications are for anything from work to their social interactions to their kids' education, these kinds of things, I think the better we can like build robust conversations, we can think about how we actually want like not just the technology, but our society to progress in a positive way. And I think really getting the buy-in from society in general is a big deal for us to kind of build the kinds of futures we want to move towards.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point that society needs to be involved in this. And that's why I created the AI-Lyceum, because I think it's important to have an open discussion about how to use AI in the best way, the implications from a social, technical, and ethical point of view. But also, I think having all of the sectors work together is great. I think what you're doing is really, really cool. I also think defining intelligence is very difficult. So I'm going to put a question to you. How do you define intelligence?
That's a great question. And I, what's interesting is this is the kind of question that people have wondered about for thousands of years. And you've got so many different definitions of it. And, you know, I think often we look at something about being able to, like, as an entity, being able to survive or adapt in some sort of challenging environment. So, you know, I think what we typically want to recognize is that, you know, if you think about, like, oh, I consider someone to be intelligent or something to be intelligent, right? You know, if you think about what that means, typically it's got something to do with, you know, if you throw some sort of difficulty at it, it can deal with this thing, right? So, you know, if it can, like, happily do the same day to day every day or the same task all the time, like, no matter how complex that task, we tend to not think about that as intelligent, which is interesting. So just for a second, like, you know, this is where we look at, like, philosophically, we've been looking at this question for maybe thousands of years. And then kind of as technology progresses, we get kind of AI popping up and suddenly the goalposts change. You know, like, we might have said, you know, a number of years ago that, like, wow, if you had a thing that could tell you exactly how to get from anywhere in the world to anywhere else, that would be super intelligent. And now it's like, no, that's just, you know, Google Maps or Apple Maps or something, right? And then it's like, oh, if you had a thing that you could talk to about anything, you know, on your phone, then that would be intelligence. Like, oh no, that's just Siri. Or, like, in the next generation, oh, that's ChatGPT. That's not really intelligent because it can't do this. So it's funny how, like, easily we habituate to something and we chase, I don't know, some sort of mythical idea in our heads of, like, I don't know if that means it's got to be, like, indistinguishable from humans for people to accept it on some level. But I think, to me, like, you know, kind of really what you want is something that can deal with and adapt to certain kinds of challenges, adversarial conditions or whatever in its environment. I feel strongly that, like, an intelligent entity is something that's going to be going around doing things. It's got some sort of purpose, some sort of task, some sort of agency. We like using the word agents now. To me, this is what intelligence is about. So it's about some sort of entity, some agent that can exist in some sort of environment. It's got to make decisions to be able to achieve something and can, to a certain extent, deal with adversarial conditions that might be changing over time. So to me, that's what I consider kind of an intelligent agent or entity.
Yeah, really interesting. I consider intelligence the ability to understand and act on your own thinking to solve the problem. In terms of being a professor, what does a day look like for you? And what sort of research do you conduct around this area that people would be interested to hear on this podcast?
Well, that was the real important bit at the end that's actually interesting, right? You know, there's many different aspects to it. I think it's a bit different kind of directing an institute, but on the more kind of research type front, it's working with colleagues and working with many amazing students. You know, I tend to, the way I like to do research tends to be more collaborative. So even when we've got students, often our research meetings are multiple students with multiple supervisors discussing the kinds of projects we're working on. And there, particularly, what I'm interested in is this kind of long-term decision-making type setting. Kind of technically, this area is reinforcement learning. That's usually what we think of in this area. But what I care about is these situations really that are about, I have, you know, my decision maker. Now, in many cases, this is something in simulation, in a simulated environment, but it could be a robot. We're doing a fair bit of robotics as well. And so now this thing has to be able to make some decisions to be able to achieve some outcomes. What we kind of think about a lot in our lab is focusing on really a couple key properties that we want these things to be more general. But we also want them to be safe in what they're doing. And so a lot of our work is around building new frameworks, thinking about new ways that we can accomplish this. So how do you do that? Well, there's a lot of different ways. We often think about, how can I break down what the agent's trying to accomplish into a way that might give it some reusable knowledge? Right. So, and this could be in many different forms. This could be saying, well, if I'm trying to solve very hard problems, what I might need along the way are skills. So if I can learn skills that are reusable, then these are things I can piece together to solve hard problems. Or alternatively, maybe I need some kind of knowledge about the world. This might be something that if I use a certain skill, this is what's likely to happen. It might be knowledge about, if I interact with some certain element of the world, this is what happens. Like I don't know, push the light switch, the lights will go on. Unless they're already on, then maybe they go off. And, you know, these kinds of things that might help you reason through general settings of problems. So these will be the kind of things that we want to think about. A lot of our work then says, well, if we can factorize your interactions with the world, the required knowledge about the world, can we then piece this together in ways that are maybe aligned to human communication, or let us say something or prove something about how the behavior might work? So, for example, we've got a whole big research program where we've been looking at, can I take kind of a human requirement? So maybe I can specify a task that I want my agent to perform. So maybe I want my robot to be able to take certain people coffee and then deliver mail to other people and then, you know, do a variety of tasks like this, but also never enter certain areas in the office building or make sure that I don't bump into people and this kind of thing. Can I express that in a human-friendly language, maybe translate it into through some mechanism into kind of what these behaviors should look like, but do it in a way that I can prove that those conditions will always be met? So we do a lot of this kind of work in trying to kind of make sure that we get to increase the generalizability of our agents, but also maintaining safety kind of from the beginning. So this is kind of the sort of thing that we focus on in our lab, but we also do some more applied stuff. And on that front, I think one of the more exciting ones we have at the moment is we've got there's a site just outside of Johannesburg, about 45 minutes outside of Johannesburg, called the Cradle of Humankind, because there are these huge cave systems there where apparently more hominid fossils have been discovered there than anywhere else in the world. And that site is a research site owned by our university. So we've got a big project at the moment where we're kind of putting robots into the caves to help map the caves, and with the long-term ambition of, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could discover some sort of human ancestor with a robot?
So that's really interesting, because I'm a big fan of Plato's Allegory of the Cave, which is obviously, as we know, an allegory that explains the theory of what's real or what's not and the interpretation of the world, right?
And my so we just took it literally.
Yes, exactly.
We went to find a cave.
Exactly. So you've got your cave, right? But how I've applied it to AI is, in the cave, you have people holding up certain symbols and icons. There's a fire, and on the wall there are shadows. People think that this is reality, who are chained inside the cave. AI thinks that the labeled data, if it's called an apple and it is an apple, it knows that apple is an apple, but it hasn't ever really tasted an apple. It has never held an apple. It's never seen an apple tree. So the context of the world itself is in us. We have the wisdom. of being outside the cave. The AI is in the device, it's in the data centers, it's in the cloud. It's not physically in the world just yet. And I think robotics is going to change that. It's going to make AI anthropomorphized as much as it can be. But a lot of people might think, how does that assist me in my day-to-day life? What sort of day-to-day activities do you think you could see robots assisting in the next 5-10 years?
So firstly, on kind of the kind of technical and philosophical aspects of this, I completely agree. So, you know, we are very motivated by kind of embodied intelligence in the work that we do. That's one of the reasons we've been pushing more into robotics. You know, if you could argue that, like, say ChatGPT understands what it means to sit, but it understands it maybe in a textual sense, like that, you know, sitting has something to do with chairs, and, like, you know, it could construct a lot of sentences describing this for you, but its world is text. But you could give, you know, certain versions images as well, and it might understand what sitting is from the perspective of what it looks like in images, right? But you couldn't say that it understands it in the same way we do, because it's been standing all day and now its legs are really tired and it wants to sit down. And so there's certain concepts like that I think you need to be, you know, the more your functionality matches the functionality of a human, the more your kind of interpretations of concepts are going to align in a kind of multimodal sense, right? Again, we could describe all of this in text, but, you know, until you've had that thing of, like, I've been walking around the shopping mall all day looking for this thing and now I'm exhausted, I need to sit. You know, until you've actually done something like that, like, the notion of sitting is going to mean something different to you. And so I think that's important.
That's really true. It's like when you're on a plane and you've sat for 10 hours flying to another country and you want to stand up. The opposite of that, but similar sort of principle. I like that, actually, because you're talking about the need to do something gives it context. So the need to eat, the hunger around food is what gives the food context of being needed. That's really
interesting. Yeah, I guess, you know, in a similar way, like, yeah, with the sitting thing, that, like, you know, if you ask someone about sitting, you could describe in words, like, that feeling of kind of cramps you get from a long-haul flight or something. Until you felt it, it means something different to you. Or, like, you could understand maybe conceptually what it is to be colorblind or something. But if you've never actually experienced it, it means something different to you. Like, you know, it's kind of wired into your brain differently to what someone who experiences that would have.
Yeah, it's like the definition of empathy is the EM means in, and pathy comes from pathos, meaning to feel. So in feeling, you can't understand something really like that unless you've actually felt it. So that's where the word empathy comes from. So you mentioned the word, well, you mentioned two words, reinforcement learning and multimodal. Do you want to, can you explain what those two terms mean? You might have a point to make before those, but if you could explain what those mean, that'd be great.
No, sure, that's great. Okay, so reinforcement learning is kind of a subset of machine learning. So kind of historically, it was always described as being these three areas of machine learning, of supervised learning, which is learning from kind of labeled data. This is a cat, this is a dog, and getting, you know, feeding these images to a machine to get it to be able to make those predictions. That's the training process. You'd have your unsupervised learning, which is, I've got a whole lot of data. We don't know what's a cat or a dog, but maybe if it looks at enough images, it could be like, wait a second, there's two different animals in these things. Reinforcement learning is a very different kind of problem, and it talks more to what I was speaking about with agents earlier on. So the reinforcement learning problem is really about saying that I'm, you know, you think of your machine as an agent that's got to make decisions. But kind of the impact of it, like, its decisions make some sort of impact in the world. So we typically think we can model the situation is, you've got your decision maker, your agent, and it's got to learn how to take a sequence of actions, each of which might affect the world. So it might be that it moves its leg and now it's in a slightly different position, or it might be that it pushed a button and now the lights are on, or it might be that it said something and now there's different kind of knowledge out there in the world. So it's going to make a decision, but those decisions affect the world. And it's not that a single decision is important. right? So in the case of, like, you know, your thing that can say, is this a cat or a dog, is making a decision, but it's like a single decision. What's important here is that the kind of outcomes would be from a whole sequence of things. So think in this case of learning to play chess or Go, or learning to drive a car, or learning to play football, or anything like this, right? It's not like each individual action might not be that important. Maybe there are cases where it is, but it's really about a whole sequence of things that lets you win the game, or lets you grow your crops well, or lets you drive to your destination. And the challenge here is it's not like, I can see, it's not about like, whenever the world looks exactly like this, this is what I have to do, because there's too many options, right? So you've got to be able to, typically, to some extent, reason through what might happen in the future, to be able to maybe predict the effects of your actions, but also to have some way of saying, like, I know what a desirable or undesirable outcome looks like. You know, I know if I fall down the stairs, I've been told that's bad. If I bring a human a cup of coffee, maybe that's good. But each step along the way, I've got to kind of figure out myself what is good and bad here. So this, you can almost think of this problem as like the problem that we have as humans in like trying to exist in the world. We start off with a case where, you know, we're kind of flapping our arms and legs around randomly. And we've slowly got to build up our knowledge of like how our bodies work, how we achieve goals. We've got to learn putting your hand on a stove is a bad thing. Falling down the stairs is a bad thing. And also, you know, having your hand very close to the stove is kind of bad. And, you know, we build up all of this kind of behavioral knowledge. But the way we do that is really through trial and error learning. Sometimes good things happen, sometimes bad things happen. We've got to build up these kind of models in our head of like how the world works, how our bodies work in the world. And that's kind of what reinforcement learning is trying to emulate through kind of similar types of processes. The other one you asked was about multimodal. And multimodal, kind of, we often talk about models being multimodal, or sensing data being multimodal, or something like this. This really refers to like the information that your intelligent agent is working with coming from different modalities, right? So it wouldn't be just text, but it might be text and images, or maybe audio and images, or, you know, so the idea is really that we're trying to bridge, and this is what you see in like some of the newer kind of large models that will have like be able to work with vision and language at the same time, or audio and language and so on, is that, you know, when we're operating in the world, we're using kind of all our different senses to give us a more complete picture of the world, right? So this is, you know, what I'm seeing, but it's also what I'm feeling with my hands. It's also that I can feel in my inner ear. I can feel the orientation of my body. I can feel any acceleration. My brain fuses all this information together to give me a more complete picture of the world, more so than if I was lacking any one of these modalities. And it's super useful to have this. So, you know, you might think, for example, of the task of, let's say I'm a robot and I want to be able to pick up a mug that's like sitting on my desk. Okay. If I'm, you know, your obvious thing might be, okay, I'm going to use just visual information to be able to do this. And you can do that. And in fact, this is how the field of grasping has worked for a very long time, that, you know, you're going to take the, you know, try work out the coordinates of where something is in your visual field and figure out where your arm has to be to grab it. But actually, you need more than that. You actually need to know where your arm is. You need to fuse what you're seeing visually with kind of the angles of each joint in your arm. And like, because without that, you don't know what you're supposed to do next. Right? Maybe you can figure it out from the image of what you're seeing, but that's really hard compared to if I knew my arm was at roughly this angle and so on. But then it turns out we take it a step further. If you include tactile information, so what you're feeling in your hand, turns out this is really powerful. So if you can't feel anything in your hand, right? So if your hand was completely numb, picking something up is difficult. You've got to be really precise about where you put your hand, when you close it, how hard you apply pressure and so on. It seems like we don't do that much in the way of calculations from our visual information in this case. We put our hand in roughly the right place and close it until we feel certain pressure, And they were like, aha, I've grabbed it. And you can kind of get this if you've ever like sat in an awkward position and your arm goes numb. And then you try to pick something up. It's really difficult because you're not getting that tactile feedback. So if we're able to do like our brains do in our kind of machine learning models and fuse information from really these different modalities, it helps us solve problems in firstly easier ways, but secondly, it makes it more robust. You know, if your mug is way heavier than you expected, right, you can deal with that because you feel, hang on, as you're lifting it up, it's not responding in the way you think it is. You think it's supposed to. Or, I don't know, if a handle was squishy or something, you'd change the way you move, right? You're fusing all this information together. And so this is where, you know, a lot of work in different areas of AI, right? Again, from the large models, but through to robotics, they're all trying to move to this more multimodal state because it gives us this kind of more complete picture of the world.
Really fascinating stuff. And I like how you mentioned the grasping thing. If I pick up a mug and it's too heavy, I'd have to adjust my sense of understanding how to pick it up.
This is why all of this information, like, you know, if you're thinking about different modalities, if one's not giving you enough information, you know, you can rely on other ones to help finish the picture for you.
Exactly. So you mentioned, we've talked about reinforcement learning, we've talked about multimodal. Let me see what other questions I've got here. This is an interesting one. How do you balance the interplay between human intelligence and machine intelligence?
When you say the interplay, what do you mean there is like how they interact with each other?
Yes, how we interact with each other in terms of robotics. How do we maybe in the future work with robots on ChatGPT? How do we use ChatGPT as best as we can? What part of our life do we use for ChatGPT for any of these tools? And how can these tools help us to enhance ourselves?
I think that's a super interesting question because there are so many different aspects to it. And, you know, these range from, you know, I've done a lot of work in the past thinking about you know, what we call theory of mind, or in this case, machine theory of mind, where, you know, if you and I are collaborating, how do we do that? Well, And you know, technically, there's always a lot of different ways to solve these problems. Maybe if you have a big enough, like, I don't know, language model, and it's seen enough data, then it can predict stuff well. I tend to not always find that the interesting way to think about a problem. So, you know, you can be kind of explicit about this sometimes. So, you know, we've done some work where we say, well, what's actually going on there is when we're interacting, you're trying to make predictions of what I'm going to do, or in fact, predictions of what maybe my internal mental state might be looking like. You know, what kind of things are going on? In a simple case, maybe am I distracted? Am I tired? And that might be like important if, let's say, you and I are collaborating in a work environment. And, you know, if you're the robot and I'm the human and you see that I'm really starting to zone out a bit, maybe that's a good time for you to like try and, like, you know, get my attention, or maybe take over the task from me. But you can do better if you're trying to, again, model the kind of mental state than if you're just looking at the behavior. Because, again, this would be about, like, trying to fuse together what you're seeing, come up with a model that explains what might be happening. So there's like, nice probabilistic ways you can think about this. And I think this is a cool way to get humans and machines to interact is really around being explicit about the reasoning processes that the other ones might be doing, and thinking about how can we kind of model this in a useful way that lets us collaborate interestingly. But I think like there's so many different like aspects of this. So, you know, you can think that in the case of a human interacting with a machine, there could be like, you know, downstream psychological effects. Like, what impact does it have on a human to behave or to interact with a machine that behaves in a certain way? And, you know, there's so many different ways you can take this. One angle that I think is quite interesting is kind of the Westworld angle. You know, let's say that you've got a human interacting with a machine, and let's say we knew that the machine couldn't feel pain or suffer. I mean, how we would know that is a whole different question, but, you know, just for argument's sake. And now, let's say this is a bit of an extreme example, but let's say then that meant you could be in an environment where you could do terrible things to these machines and exploit them, or kill them or something, and it's fine because it's not suffering. But what does that do for our own psyche? Like, if that machine was human-like enough for us to kind of be able to interact with it as a human, but then do these terrible things, so what does it mean about the way we perceive other people? And I think these kind of questions start getting super interesting, bringing in aspects of psychology and philosophy and so on. Because, you know, we're in this kind of setting now where we're kind of in relation to other intelligent creatures. I mean, we've always been in relation to other intelligent creatures, like, you know, firstly other humans and then other animals. But somehow we've had, you know, millions of years to adapt to this situation. We've now suddenly got this new type of kind of alien intelligence in front of us that can, in a way, mimic anything from a chess grandmaster to, you know, visually start looking a hell of a lot like a human. Now this is a thing that we're not used to dealing with. So what are the ramifications for these kinds of interactions on the rest of our lives? And I think this is where you're starting to see these cases of people falling in love with their large language models, or having these like very strange interactions, because like our brains weren't, you know, have never had to deal with this kind of setting before. All we can do is map it onto something that looks like what we're used to, which is basically anthropomorphize it. And then be like, okay, I can treat this like a human or like a dog or like whatever, but that's not always appropriate. And I think this is interesting. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface on, like, you know, what are the weird ways that the brain freaks out when dealing with, you know, different strange entities that can behave, you know, on the one hand in very reasonable ways, but on the other hand can mess up things that we laugh at and become memes online. I think that's very cool.
It is very cool, and I'm sure some people on this in this episode listening will find it very, very exciting. Some might find it very maybe daunting or unknown. My last question to you is, if you had any question to ask the viewers, which they have to answer in the comments ideally, what would you ask them?
That's a great question. It's very meta in this way. I've got to ask a great question based on your great question.
Yeah.
There's so many ways that I could take this. I think, you know, the kind of big questions to me, and I'm using this like kind of thinking out loud here. I think there's many big open questions at the moment, and these range from things that look more technical. And there, I think particularly one of the more interesting things is around like consciousness. Like, what would you need to see in a machine for you to think it's conscious? I think this kind of thinking is very interesting. But there's also big questions around kind of our kind of societal development, like how we'd want to see society evolve alongside machines. Now, there's so many discussions on this front about, you know, the positives and the negatives and the variety of different views and the variety of different timelines and so on. But I'm curious what people would think. What is the future we'd like to see? How would we like to see, you know, if we're building this technology that's, again, at its core around intelligence, it's around doing the thing that, you know, we see ourselves as being separate from other entities because we have so much of it, you know, whatever that all means. But, you know, fundamentally, when we have a hard problem, we typically solve it with more intelligence, right? Whether that's an individual problem or a societal problem. So as we're building this technology, which is more and more generally capable, now if I'm ignoring what the timelines look like, what is the future we should be building towards? What are the things that we think are ridiculous about our current way of being? What is the kind of end state we should be aiming towards, and or maybe that we should be aiming away from in the way we not just build the technology, but deploy it, integrate it into our societies? Where should we be going with all of this? And I think, you know, a lot of people have some sort of intuition of like, oh, this will be better, or that will be better. We've got to make sure this doesn't go catastrophically and so on. But to actually sit back and say, you know, with all the, like, if we could have infinite intelligence, what would we do with it? Like, I don't know. That feels a good question for us to be asking.
Good, really good questions. I think the first one for me is interesting. I'd say for me, consciousness is the machine's awareness of where it came from and who created it. And asking questions like, why am I here? The existentialism is why something is conscious. It's asking
without being pre-programmed to ask that.
Yes, exactly.
Right. But how we know it hasn't just read that from the data and like, this is a good question to ask.
That's true. And how do we not know that they're acting in a way now which makes us think that they're not conscious, but they really are. So that's interesting. But I'd say that that's everything. So it's been a great podcast. I'm sure everyone will love it. And you've got an amazing mind with loads of ideas. And the robotic space is something that's going to creep upon us, I think, in the next 5 years. Our focus at the moment is LLMs on a computer or on a mobile, but the robotic space is developing kind of behind the scenes in terms of mainstream
media. Quite quickly,
media.
Actually.
Yes, exactly. So I imagine in 5 years, I mean, I've got a robot vacuum at home, a robot vacuum cleaner that automatically goes across the edges of the room, middle of the room, wherever the dust is, and it has a camera. So I can imagine in 5-10 years, there's going to be an abundance of robotic equipment that we can use in our houses. Like our robot.
I think much maybe sooner. Maybe not.
Really? Oh wow. Okay. Do you want to give me one, and I can give a review for it.
Well, there's so much work being done. Like now, robot dogs are becoming kind of ubiquitous. I think we've still got to find the killer apps for these things, but in a lot of inspection type applications, people doing a lot with like humanoid robots now, and I think it's only a matter of time before we see these things integrated into like food delivery or something like that. It will be, I don't know, exciting times ahead.